Well, good morning, everyone. It's really great to be back here. That reading puts me in mind of something you said in my introduction, so I'm going to have to mention that before I start my talk. For a lot of years, I made my living as a carpenter. I still do some repairs and remodeling. And I used to also play music in many venues, and I found myself playing If I Were a Carpenter, which is a nice song. And one day, I was thinking about it, and really, that song, If I Were a Carpenter and You Were a Lady, Would You Love Me Anyway? Hold it. That's saying like the carpenter is, you know, some lower form of life. So I rewrote the song as if I were a lawyer. And a little bit shady, Would You Love Me Anyway? I spoke at the UU in Franklin 2 weeks ago, and they've got you beat all to heck on view, but I haven't been in any UU church around the region that has better music. I really enjoyed that guitar music. "15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum." When Ron contacted me around the end of June and requested that I speak here today on Labor Day weekend, I said, sure, I'll come up with a topic. I tend to come up with a topic before I write a talk because I sort of, then I can write to it. So on July 11th, I woke up at 4:30 a.m. with a great title for today's talk, Yo-Ho-Ho and a Bottle of Rum, together with the subtitle, Black Death, White Sugar, and the Quest for a Living Wage. 3 weeks later, I sat down to actually write this talk and abruptly realized I was going to have to connect a whole lot of dots over about 7 centuries. To begin with, I should probably have said brown sugar, even though the imagery of black death and white sugar seemed pretty strong. So I did the only reasonable thing a person in that situation can do. I went outside and pulled weeds. So a little later, I tried again. The first obvious question to ask is, what were 15 men doing on a dead man's chest? Was he still breathing when they sat down? Thinking back to my childhood, I recalled that my immediate assumption when I first heard that song was that they were sitting on a treasure chest. But Wikipedia set me straight. There's an island in the West Indies called Dead Chest Island. It's a rocky little bump with no trees or water, and it looks a lot like a chest of a person floating on their back. Legend has it that Blackbeard once left several unruly pirates on the island with just a bottle of rum each. And as the story goes, when the ship returned about a month later, a few of them were still alive. Robert Louis Stevenson actually wrote the song, 15 Men on a Dead Man's Chest, for his book, Treasure Island. It's all a good story, but it seems that Blackbeard was actually quite a gentleman and ran his boat with the support and consent of his crew, who he apparently paid pretty well. He paid what we would call a living wage, or at least a fair crew share, because he believed that fear was better. He avoided violence because he believed that fear was a better method of controlling and scaring his prey than actually killing anybody. And his business, of course, was looting merchant ships from the Indies up to coastal Carolina. Piracy was one of the reasons why a lot of those merchant ships were carrying molasses. Not many pirates wanted barrels of molasses, which is a sticky mess, especially after you lob some cannonballs into the opposing ship. And there wasn't much of a black market, or you might call it a brown market, for molasses. Well, I could see at this point I was getting ahead of myself, so I went back to weeding for a while. And pretty soon I realized I should have started with Christopher Columbus. In the late 15th century, European ships had improved to the point that exploration and trade were becoming popular with queens and kings. The marvelous goodies that had come from the Far East via the Silk Road had dried up when the Turks captured Constantinople and cut off trade to the east in 1453. So the Portuguese were exploring the African coast and trying to sail south around Africa to get to the east, and Columbus convinced the king and queen of Spain he could beat the Portuguese by sailing east. He promised to make them very, very rich, which is something queens and kings like even better than spices and silk. Columbus promised gold, but in the course of his voyages, he didn't find much, so he switched to slaves, which were also becoming popular in Europe, with a regular trade developing along the gold coast of Africa. Slavery had always enjoyed some popularity in Europe. I mean, go back to Rome and Greece, there were certainly slaves. But there was a new reason for this demand. In the 14th and 15th century, the Black Death swept Europe. One-third or possibly two-thirds of the people living there died during the course of about 100 years. Historians still debate the numbers. The principal disease itself was bubonic plague, but that was just the beginning of the problems. Many farmers quit planting crops, believing the end times had come, and so starvation ensued. The germ theory of disease was way off in the future, and whole towns full of Jews were murdered because people believed they were poisoning the wells. Witchcraft was blamed, so witches were burned, and cats were exterminated because they were obviously involved in witchcraft. My four cats and I have long thought that was one of the high ironies of the period, because cats are the best rodent control thing in the world, and it was rat fleas that were spreading bubonic plague. So they were getting rid of the solution to their problem. The results of the Black Death were extremely beneficial for survivors. There were a lot of empty houses. Housing became cheaper. Demand for goods collapsed, so prices fell. And labor was in short supply, so wages rose. Landlords, desperate for workers, were outbidding each other. Serfs who didn't like their treatment could leave, knowing they could find another place to settle down. The first strikes occurred, and in some places, the workers took over whole municipalities and regions. You can see why there was a burgeoning demand for slaves. So when gold failed to materialize, despite the very reasonable rule laid down by Columbus, which was that every native on every island he visited had to deliver a certain amount of gold each year or have their arms cut off, he still didn't get enough gold, so he started shipping slaves to Europe. Big problem. Over half of each boatload died en route, and the survivors didn't last long. Other than the Vikings way up north and about 1,000 years earlier, no, not 1,000, 500 years earlier, there hadn't been any contact between European and Asian germs and the North American and South American populations for a long, long time. Bubonic plague, smallpox, measles, and other diseases spread very quickly among the natives. Columbus and crew also apparently took home syphilis, which was new to Europe, and I'm not sure the kings and queens expected that. But this continued everywhere Europeans landed. Disease ran ahead of advancing troops and settlers, ravaging two continents. Cortez conquered the Aztecs before disease hit Mexico City, what we now think is Mexico City, but most of the Incas were dead by the time Pizarro arrived in Peru, and most North American tribespeople never saw a white face before they died because disease traveled ahead of the white settlers. What to do? Well, one of the other things that queens and kings had taken a fancy to and that the Turks had cut off was sugar. Sugar had become domesticated in Asia a couple thousand years ago, and then in about 1,000 years later in India, they figured out how to make granulated sugar. And then they started growing it in Mesopotamia, in the Fertile Crescent. But the Turks had cut all that off when they captured Constantinople. So now there was a sugar shortage in Europe. Portugal realized that Brazil was a good place to grow sugar, and they started in there, and soon Spain and England began to grow sugar on their islands. And in very short order, we had monocrops of sugar all over the islands, along with some limes, because limes, too, had been cut off from the east. They were from Mesopotamia as well. And you've heard the old stories about the limeys, the British sailors, who always carried limes to help put off scurvy. But now they had these big monocrops that they were establishing, and the workers were disappearing because all the natives were dying if they weren't being killed in the first place, and they needed workers. Well, the slave trade had started between the Gold Coast and Europe, but now they started bringing slaves from Africa to the islands in order to have workers there. Then someone invented the daiquiri. Actually, what happened is this. Fermented sugarcane had been consumed for many years, but but nobody had distilled it until slaves in Brazil and the islands started distilling it into rum, which made it tastier and, of course, much stronger. And soon there was a thriving rum trade from the islands to Europe because kings and queens and their friends all wanted rum at their bars at this point. So they started shipping rum. Big problem, the pirates started intervening because rum was easily resellable, and the pirates drank it as well. And it also seems that sailors were pretty fond of rum. And so sometimes you'd load barrels and they wouldn't all be full when they got to the other port. And then another problem occurred. There was a big shortage of fuel in the islands. It takes a lot of heat to distill liquor. And they'd cut down all the trees in order to plant all these plantations. And even the trees that were there were not particularly good fuel. If you've ever tried to burn a palm tree, you'd know what that's all about. But in New England, there was an excess of hardwood. They were trying to clear places for farming and for sheep raising. And so it was a perfect place to have lots of leftover firewood that could be used for firewood. At the same time, there was a shortage of firewood in Europe happening. This was the era when forestry began to be big. The foresters who came here to start our national forests learned in Europe about replanting trees. There was a shortage of wood fuel there. They started shipping the molasses from the islands to Boston, near y'all. No, y'all. You're from up there. Yeah. And then using the fuel there, they distilled it into rum, and then they took the rum to Europe or to the Gold Coast, picked up slaves, took them to the islands, and we had a triangular trade route going on then. The rum was a lot safer between Boston and Europe than coming up the coast of the Carolinas because pirates have more trouble intervening on the high seas. When you're going along the coast, they could dash out and grab it. So the sailors still drank some, but the piracy was less. Blackbeard was out of luck. And although most Americans remember the Tea Act when we think about our revolution, the Tea Party and all, and the Stamp Act, which was immediately precipitated that, when we had to have a stamp on every piece of paper that was printed on, the first protests were against the Molasses Act, when Britain was trying to force American colonials to use British molasses and not French or Spanish molasses. So it was a price support structure. Most American brewers didn't pay much attention, but it was still a big factor in that rebellious spirit in Boston during that time. Along the way, sugar became more and more available and was tremendously popular with English tea drinkers. You remember the song, Drill Ye Terriers Drill, oh, Drill Ye Terriers Drill, let's work all day for sugar in your tay down beyond the railway. In fact, over the years, it became abundantly clear to rulers around the globe that assuring their populations of a steady supply of sugar and other sweeteners, along with alcohol, was a very good way to dampen discontent and revolutions and demand for higher wages and things like that. When was the last time you were in a government office where there weren't bowls of candy on the desks? Or have you taken a good look at Ingalls? At how many aisles are devoted to candy, cookies, soft drinks, and beer and wine? I mean, that's all part of that whole sugar thing. And, of course, there's corn sweetener now in almost everything you buy that has been adjusted other than fresh food. Sometimes I think people are almost like hummingbirds that I see at my theater. We chase each other away from our sugar. We fight over sugar, you know. And certainly they fought over the islands down there. The sugar was an important colonial thing during those years, and it still remains that. Sugar producers hold tremendous political sway in Florida, helping to keep prices up on sugar, up just high enough so everybody can still get it, but so the sugar producers make a lot of money. Now, then came cotton. So now we've started to, the Europeans have started to spread into the South and realized that cotton could be grown well in the South, needed more labor. The slaves that had been imported to the islands now were being brought into the United States, and most of us are pretty familiar with that. After the Civil War, sharecropping became the standard, really essentially replacing one direct slavery with a land-type slavery, an indentured sort of slavery. And it took until the 1950s before hand-picking cotton was passé. I mean, although the gin helped process cotton, It had to be hand-picked, and so there was still a big demand for labor in the South for years after the Civil War. During the Civil War, somewhere between 650,000 and 850,000 men died, most from disease. I haven't been able to trace the specific effect on wages or as a labor shortage, but there certainly was a labor shortage. And in the South in particular, the planters began to complain about they couldn't get people to work for them and began to bid up slightly the wages in the South. Especially black women dropped out of the labor force, seeing that they, no longer being slaves, they now could take care of their families, raise some food at home, make some clothing, do all the household things that they hadn't really had time to do when they were enslaved. In the North, a lot of widows started going back to work, going to work for the first time. Again, they needed an income. The factories needed people to work. And so the whole labor picture started changing. But one thing that's really clear, although I couldn't find specifics about it, is that unions began to gain strength after the Civil War. And that was because laborers had leverage, because there was a shortage of labor. As in your yellow sheet in your program, there's a song about Labor Day. The year was 1882 when the Labor Party made its debut. And the first Labor Day came around in the 1880s. Well, that's part of that whole uprising of labor that occurred during that period. National Guard and federal troops were frequently called in to break strikes, and many organizers were gunned down or executed. Populism and socialism found tens of thousands of advocates. In 1900, there were 2 million union members in America, less than 3% of the labor force. By 1920, it was more than 12% of the labor force. 50 years after the Civil War, another plague swept the world, the flu pandemic, which was sometimes called the Spanish flu, though Spain had nothing to do with it. In the U.S., an estimated 675,000 people died. Globally, it killed more people in one season than the bubonic plague had killed in 100 years. Unlike the strains of flu we're familiar with today, it tended to most affect people between 20 and 30. We don't really know why, but it was young, the young workers were the most affected. And studies following that showed that because labor was less mobile in those days, economies tended to be more local. And they've established very clearly that the areas that were most heavily affected by the Spanish flu saw the biggest increases in wages after the flu had gone by. Again, a labor shortage pushed up the value of labor. During the 1920s, powerful business interests fought off unions with open shop rules like the ones we still have here in North Carolina. After the Depression, unions successfully pressed for federal legislation, though, and greatly improved wages and benefits for many American workers. That pandemic was coupled with the devastation of World War I, in which somewhere between 9 and 15 million people died in Europe. Because the physical destruction never reached the United States, we benefited enormously. It's sort of like after the bubonic plague. I mean, we were in a great position. We had a big demand worldwide for our goods. And this happened again following World War II. Wages rose here on the basis of a very big strengthening economy. The infrastructure in Europe and in Japan had been devastated, and we took up the slack. Now, while large companies are mostly very resistant to raising base pay. Oh, hold it. I skipped a page. Nope. The greatest downward pressure on wages today is arguably mechanization. As one wag has it, the factory of tomorrow will be run by one man and one dog. The man is there to feed the dog, and the dog is there to keep the man from touching the machines. But automation, coupled with global population growth, and the ease with which employers can move across national borders is really changing labor and wages globally. Now, factory jobs offered a way out of the South to earlier generations. We most noticeably in the South had the great migration of African Americans who moved up to the industrial North, again, after the Civil War, coming into this century, the 20th century. Wow, this is the 21st. Yeah, and to the new automobile factories and other plants up north. But In the South here, where we're seeing a resurgence of automobile factories now and manufacturing, our laws, the open shop laws like in North Carolina, are still depressing wages together with robotics. If you went into a car plant, like a new Toyota plant in the South, it would be very, very different from the old GM plants in Detroit. A whole lot of it is being done automatically, which means the workforce is smaller and also more poorly paid. Today's living wage campaigns face enormous hurdles thrown up by both mechanization and politicians reliant on corporate donations. As Elizabeth Warren pointed out last February, if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity over the last several years, the minimum wage today would be $22 an hour. Productivity went up. Wages did not. In the same conversation, economist Robert Reich said, I think that Senator Warren's $22 is certainly defensible, but it would be at least $15 an hour, or double what it is right now. According to Just Economics, based in Asheville, a living wage is the minimum amount a worker must earn to afford his or her basic necessities without public or private assistance. In short, a living wage is really what would be a just minimum wage. The living wage for a single individual living in Western North Carolina, according to Just Economics, is $11.85 an hour without employer health care, or $10.35 an hour with health insurance provided by the business. While large companies are mostly resistant to raising base pay, small businesses tend to be more in touch with their employees. They're part of the community. And Just Economics has certified well over 200 businesses in Western North Carolina as living wage employers. The cities of Asheville, Montreat, and Weaverville have all adopted living wage rates for full-time employees as well. In Asheville, we even voted to make living wages a requirement of city contracts, so that any contractor we hired would be required to pay that same living wage. Unfortunately, the General Assembly killed that last year and banned cities in North Carolina from implementing any sort of wage requirements on contracts. Okay, back to the pirate story. One of the early names for rum was Killdevil, memorialized in this state in the name of Killdevil Hills, where the Wright brothers first flew in 1903. The area got its name because shipwrecks were once common in the area, and enterprising locals often salvaged barrels of rum which floated in and buried them in the dunes for later retrieval. So that's why it's called Killdevil Hills. Now, interestingly, after that first flight, several years later, 1911, 8 years later, Orville Wright returned to Killdevil Hills. The prevailing winds make it a good place for those old airplanes to try out. And he set a new glider record, a world glider record. He glided into the wind for more than 10 minutes from the top of one of the dunes, but he made almost no forward progress. It just sort of picked him up and then set him back down again. And looking at the plight of working people through the centuries, that could be said of the struggle toward a living wage. Sometimes the demand for increased wages and more benefits gets airborne, but the aircraft seems as likely to move backwards as forwards. Today in the United States, the wealth gap, that is the disparity between rich and poor, is arguably the highest it has ever been. 1% of the people control 25% of the wealth. Globally, the richest 1% control 45% of the wealth. In former colonial territories around the globe, as fast as countries shook off colonial rule, it seems like powerful elites moved in and started sending all their wealth into Swiss bank accounts. And in China and Russia, communists who once promised to level everything for everyone, as soon as the communist systems collapsed in both China and the USSR, the powerful elites started funneling all their money into Swiss bank accounts and et cetera. And we see the same kind of stratification of wealth, maybe even more so in those countries than we see in the United States. Meanwhile, increasingly automated factories and farms need fewer and fewer workers. Industry moves around the globe to employ whichever workforce will labor for the lowest price. So in conclusion, in playing the devil's advocate, a not illogical supposition one might reach is the best hope for a general pay increase for workers of the world is another devastating pandemic. H1N1, anyone? Ebola? Yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum.